Welcome to Season 2 of How to Scale, the podcast by Frog Capital focused on helping software companies successfully scale up. In Season 1, we covered a range of topics with our group of operating partners, who have learned from years of experience the different challenges all companies face on their way to scale. This is part of Frog's scale-up methodology, which brings together insights and tools to help improve companies' probability of reaching sustainable profitability. My name is Jens Düring. I'm one of the senior partners at Frog Capital. We invest in purpose-driven European software companies in the scale-up phase. In Season 2, myself and my colleagues are interviewing seasoned professionals in our network who share our passion for scaling purpose-driven software companies in Europe.
Hello and welcome. My name is Mike Reed. I'm senior partner of Frog Capital, and I'm delighted to be here today with Dawn Marriott from HG Capital. We're going to be talking about how teams need to scale through the scale-up phase. So Dawn, maybe a little bit of an intro from you around your journey, which is pretty interesting.
Well, firstly, thanks for having me along, Mike. I've been genuinely really looking forward to this conversation. And I hope that we can really get into the content. So I'll be very brief on myself. So 20 years working, growing a company that became listed called Capita. 7 years ago, I joined private equity. I'm a partner there, but I tend to spend most of my time focused on how we grow the companies that we invest in. Mm-hmm. I'm a mom, I've got three kids, very busy, love sport and workaholic.
Very good. And maybe just to dwell on a little bit, because on the Capita piece particularly, I saw you've done a lot of M&A work as well as growing. So I guess we'll touch on that later, but just give the audience a little bit of a sense of that.
Yeah. So Capita was an amazing organization to work for. I'd have probably done it for free. I learned so much. I loved all the people I worked with, customers and also colleagues. And a big part of the growth story, you're absolutely right, was around M&A. So during the time I was there, I was probably directly involved in over 50 acquisitions. Mm. We did them rapidly. So generally, if we couldn't acquire something in 4 to 6 weeks, we ruled it out. We didn't participate very much in processes. It was all about how do we build relationships? How do we find companies that aren't for sale? And how do we add value to those companies? So I learned a huge amount about doing M&A. Buying companies, and I now call it investing. I've obviously moved into the world of private equity. But it was a fantastic foundation for actually then moving into private equity.
So high growth companies, you've seen a lot. So if we start with around the leadership team and the management, broader management, and how that changes through that doesn't change. Tell us a little bit about your views on that.
Yeah. So I think when you're growing a company, and it doesn't matter if you've got 5 employees or 5,000, I think the same thing applies here. When you're growing a company, you need different skills and different types of people for the different stages of growth that that business goes through. And as the leader of a company that's high growth or wants to be high growth, I think you have to get comfortable with that. Mm. And that sometimes means you have to move people on that you like. And that people that have really helped you build, if you're a founder, for example, people that you've really trusted and you've relied on and, you've had a great relationship, but they might not be able to make the leap to the next stage.
And the, the theme, I guess, is talked about a lot. So how have you sort of developed your experience of either seeing that change needs to happen? Maybe it was in your gut, but you didn't really realize it in your early days. What frameworks, if anything, that have you looked at to help you take the emotion out of it?
So maybe I can give an example of one and then I can tell you. And actually, I'll just answer your last point. I'm not one for frameworks. And again, that's probably just driven by the person I am and the experiences that I've had.
That'll be a relief to a lot of our audience, probably.
So when someone mentioned frameworks, I'm normally the person that starts moving towards the back of the room, starts switching off. And again, that's an interesting blend, being like that in private equity, where many of my colleagues love a good framework and use them really effectively. Yeah. But so if I give an example, so HG had invested in a business in 2016. It spent 3 years doing a lot of M&A. It acquired 50 companies to put into this organization. And then they attempted an exit. Things don't always go perfectly. And on this occasion, unfortunately for HG, it didn't go right. They didn't exit the business. They didn't sell. So then we decided that we needed to actually then go and drive the transformation that was required when you buy 50 companies and put them together. You actually do have to do something. So I stepped in there as the CEO in 2019. By the end of the first week, I'd had a conversation with the CFO who, to me, he'd joined about a year earlier, and he joined because he had fantastic skills at driving exits. But he wasn't, it was obvious to me within a couple of days that he wasn't the person for, you know, detailed transformation and change. And this was going to be quite a long haul. It wasn't a 2-minute job. It was going to be a 2 to 3 year job. So by the end of the first week, we'd agreed that he wasn't the man for the job, and it wasn't right for him. Wasn't right for us. So let's part company. So he left on the Friday. In conjunction with having those exit conversations with him, I'd been furiously working through my network thinking, okay, I need this type of CFO, but they need to be available like really quick. And I have a very big network and invested time over many years building my network. I found the right guy, someone I knew. I'd worked with him many years earlier, called him up. He came in to see me and my colleagues at HG that week, same week. And then he joined about 4 or 5 days later. He then helped me on the transformation journey for about 18 months. And he was absolutely outstanding. We couldn't have done what we did without him. You know, super detailed, brilliant at driving change. But I also knew in my heart of hearts that, you know, this was about returning money to HG's clients. And so we'd have to come up against an exit. And this is quite a large organization. But I knew that this chap had never done any of that. It probably wasn't going to be any skill set. So I had to have the conversation with him that said, look, I brought you in here. We've worked together before, but this is why it's not right for you going forward and why it's not right for the business. So I then found the next person. So in total, in probably 2 years, I had 3 CFOs. And you might think that when you were going to ultimately sell a company, that that would show a weakness in the company. To me, when I then became involved heavily in the sale process, it was very important that I could talk rationally about why we did that. And it was exactly to your question of, you have the right person for the right time in the right context. And a really fantastic leader, or a good, confident leader, is someone that is willing to do those difficult things, have those exit conversations at the right time, because your job as the leader is to protect the whole organization.
Yeah, because one of the things I'm taking away is in that kind of leadership role, being clear that actually this is not about you per se, you're actually making decisions on behalf of the whole organization. So that's a really interesting thing. And then the second theme I take away is around the clarity you had about the strategic challenges that were coming up in the sort of midterm and how they brought complete clarity. Maybe for some of the audience who wish they had the clarity that you just put there, but maybe they don't, talk about kind of how you think they could help themselves gain some kind of clarity when it comes to kind of key decisions on people.
I mean, obviously I'm given examples where I had clarity. I've had plenty of times where I haven't had that clarity. So it's completely normal not to always have the answers. So your audience really ought not to be hard on themselves in that area. But if you don't have clarity, I think one of the things when you're trying to scale a business that you should always have around you for this reason, but and many other reasons, is a really strong network of other people that you can go to for help. You know, and this podcast is probably a good example of that. But I think if you're struggling to decide whether you've got the right person in the team for the journey that's ahead of you, then have some critical friends around you, some trusted people that you can go and talk to, talk it over. And I think you can, you know, you can definitely apply that that opportunity to this point, but that applies to so many things that you're going to do when you're on your journey to grow in the business. Having some good role models, having some trusted people that you know you can talk to in confidence, hopefully that have been there, seen it and done it. I generally call them the Scars and Stripes Brigade, and I always make sure that I surround myself with enough scars and stripes for people that are outside of the organization. And occasionally you'll find you might have someone inside the organization that, you know, you've got that very open relationship with.
Yeah, that's a really good.
But I think you just talk to other people and get.
Probably what I'm taking away is actually talking to them earlier than you may naturally think, because typically we see sometimes people have let things run too long.
For sure. I mean, in a very professional, constructive manner, this comment is not going to make me sound like a nice person, but I've actually removed lots and lots of people from roles. But 9 times out of 10, I'm still in touch with those people, A, because of the way I've handled it, but also because usually if the person is not right for the organisation, the job is not right for that person. Yeah. And when you actually confront it, you give them a huge sense of relief.
Yeah. That's great, because that was one of the third point I was going to pick up on earlier, and just the way you talked about talking to those people, it was just again quite strategic, both in terms of the business but also in terms of their career path.
Correct.
And so getting to that point around helping them find their next stage and less about exiting people and all that kind of stuff.
I think my word of advice here would be is do it in a really kind way. You can be very human about it, and you know, there are so many people who I've had that dialogue with, and then I've spent many an hour with them helping them get their CV right. Mm. And I don't mean giving it a cursory read. I mean properly sitting down with them and helping them. And then I've talked to other people in my network on a one-to-one basis about that person to try and help them get another role. And I've been very forward-leaning in how I've given references and the like. So I think, you know, if you're going to say that you're going to help people that you're exiting, you genuinely need to do it in a very, you know, in a timely way that gives them time.
Yeah.
And in an authentic way where you really do want to help them. And it might sound a little bit ironic. There are lots of people that I could think of where I've helped them leave a job, and in another situation, I've rehired them. I tried to do a count once of how many people I'd got of my former team working in one HG portfolio company or another, and I think I counted over 200 people. So this sort of invest in your network, treat people well in any situation, but also that you need to confront things.
Yeah,
don't bury things.
Yeah, and the authenticity that you talk about. Maybe backing up a little bit then and thinking about blind spots in leadership teams.
Yeah. So I think we all have them. I've got loads, by the way. But I think what's important is for people to have self-awareness, first and foremost. Yeah. If you know your own blind spots, particularly as a leader, it helps you enormously in building out the right type of team. It sounds a very obvious point, but if you've got a significant blind spot, make sure that someone else in your team over-indexes on that. So I think...
And to cut in, but for some people who may... Because people who have got high self-awareness then have high self-awareness. For people who maybe don't, how?
So I think whether you've got good EQ or you haven't, what's really important when you're running businesses is to ask for feedback. Sometimes if you've got high self-awareness, then hopefully the feedback is confirmatory. Mm-hmm. So that's good and it's reassuring. And if you don't necessarily have great self-awareness, you're probably going to learn a lot from asking for feedback. And I think it doesn't matter if you've got 5 employees or 500. Actually having a bit of a formal process around 360 is really healthy.
Not a framework, but a formal.
Not a framework, very informal. And literally this morning I've been doing some work with a management team where the 360 feedback has all been gathered, and then I've been having the conversation with each one of the management team. And every single person, even the ones that I would say they're super high EQ, really smart people, super self-aware, they've all learned something from having feedback. So then actually, you know, but I think it works even if there's 5 of you in a team.
Yeah.
Because how often do you actually sit down and ever say to your colleagues, what do you think of me? How am I doing? Am I good at this? You don't, because we're all so busy.
Yeah.
But I think if you make time to run a sort of, whether it's annually or biannual, whatever you do, it's worth doing because you'll probably learn a lot from it.
Yeah, I think it's such a obvious but such a critical thing that we don't maybe do in a structured way enough. And then finding back to the blind spots of the complete exec team with a leader who's willing to show and reflect their own blind spots enables them to effectively look at more intuitively around the blind spots of the whole team.
Exactly. And I think it's good if you're in a team to talk about your own blind spots with each other, because the more awareness you've got about what a strength or a weakness of somebody in the team is, the better the team is likely to perform. And I think if you end up doing this kind of a 360 analysis and you sit down and discuss it, you might actually find that the whole team has got one blind spot. And then, well, then better go and solve that.
Yeah.
It's really unhelpful.
Yeah. So then moving on to sort of from blind spots to then knowing what good looks like.
Yeah.
Particularly as the business is scaling. So what we're learning so far is, right, okay, business is growing. You're getting clear around your strategic challenges coming up. You know change is required somewhere in the exec team. How have you developed your thinking around what does good look like in the role and not hiring what you thought was good look and then turns out not to be as good as you?
So I'd say I do trust my intuition quite a lot. I do tend to make reasonably fast decisions on an individual, but I do also try to go and gather opinion without saying what do you think of that individual, but you find a discreet way. But I can maybe use another example. So HG had a particular investment that wasn't going to plan, and the investment partner leading the deal had asked me if I could go and meet the management team and pop back to the office and tell him what I thought. So I went for a morning. So I remember it's a pharma tech business. I went and met the management team. I went back to the deal partner and said, okay, this is a really great company. There's some fantastic people in it, but you've got three or four of the wrong ones. It's easy to fix. And actually, this was, at this point, it was an investment that had been written down to 20% of its value. And for HG, that was extremely unusual. Mm. They just wasn't a world that they were used to being in. So anyway, had a long discussion with the partner about how we could deal with it. And I agreed that I'd go and step in there as a CEO and fix it rather than tell him. And we made that decision very fast. Mm. So I went back to the business and the first thing I did was remove the CEO same day. Mm. Because it was obvious to me in just one day that he was the problem. The team actually were fantastic. There'd been a founder who had left about a year earlier. The new CEO had gone in. He was just the wrong person. Mm. So in the space of my probably first 4 months, I actually think I removed three or four people. Mm-hmm. I hired three or four people and I promoted three or four people. So didn't change anything else about that business. But within under a year, it had got back almost to 100% of its valuation. Mm,
fantastic.
The business was flying and we exited it. Mm. So, again, it's so important as a leader to be able to know what good looks like. Mm. And if you don't feel confident, get confident, learn, practice. Mm. And how I think I probably developed this skill was probably by making loads of mistakes. Mm. And probably not dealing with exits for some people sooner than I should have done.
Because it's a big journey to develop that sort of intuition, isn't it? Because you're hiring specialists, whether it be CF, head of finance, head of sales, head of product. And you, I guess we're back to critical friends,
correct,
scars and stripes.
Yeah, it's how you sell, you know. Anything that you're not good at, surround yourself with people that are and learn fast and be really curious.
Yeah.
No, I've worked with some, I wouldn't consider myself to be a particularly smart person. I've probably got reasonably okay EQ, but I always make sure that I surround myself with everybody else that's really smart.
And it's interesting that you, in that description, are they informal relationships? Because I guess, of course, people talk about chairs and non-execs or advisory group members.
Yeah, I think it can be both. I mean, I think, you know, we could probably have a whole podcast on chairs and what makes a good one, an effective one. But for me, the chair role is such a great opportunity to bring knowledge and experience into any stage of scaled organization. The chair is obviously there to perform a role of governance, but actually I think the chair's really, really most important thing is to make sure that they help the CEO be successful. Mm. When I chair companies, that's what I always think, that's my job.
Yeah.
Do this governance stuff as well, but actually the job is to make sure the CEO is successful.
And a great segue into then individual leadership growth as a CEO or a senior player. How have you... developed on that front? What does good look like for you in terms of particularly that balance of, yes, that person can develop into the role in a really nice way, as opposed to they probably can't and therefore a change is necessary?
Yeah. So again, I'm a big believer in you never stop learning if you're open-minded. And even if somebody as old as me, I still feel like I'm learning new things all the time. But you have to be open to want to do it. And you have to find the right vehicles to help you learn. Sometimes for me, it might be read a good book on a subject. There have been other times in my career when I have gone out and formally found a proper coach to help me deal with a specific situation in my career. I've talked quite a lot about my network and the critical friends that I have around me. I use those people. So I feel like for myself, I've been open to all methods of kind of improving.
And what's your journey been then with, you think of all the management teams you've worked with on the range of characters who are either self-learners and that proactive, as you just described, and those maybe that aren't, but could still.
So if you're not proactive and you don't sort of feel the need or you don't find it easy to go and just open your mind to learning, that's a really good example of where if you're a CEO or a founder in a business and you have that style, make sure you've got a great chair who is informally coaching you. You know, I can again think of another example. This is a business that I currently chair, so I hope the CEO isn't listening to this actually, but I'll give him as the example. It's quite a big business. He was an internal promotion. I went in to work with his company about 3 years ago to deal with founder transition. And some of the shareholders wanted an external hire. And I was like, oh, that's always really risky. Let me see if there's somebody internally. So I spent probably 2 or 3 months working my way through the organization, trying to identify someone. Anyway, I found someone. On paper, they were just not right at all. Mm-hmm. But I was absolutely confident that they had all the right characteristics and knowledge. And I was confident that I would be able to work with this person. Mm-hmm. And the blind spots they had and the lack of experience they had, I could help make up for those. Mm-hmm. And the brilliant knowledge and corporate memory and creative mind that this person had, he would be able to excel in those with more encouragement. Anyway, fast forward to where we are now today. He's probably one of the strongest CEOs I've ever worked with. He and I speak at least once every day. Mm-hmm. And that probably sounds a little intense, but it's because I compliment his blind spots. He is super, super good in so many other areas. He's a brilliant leader. He's gone from being a leader of probably 10% of the organization to now obviously being the group CEO. He and I have worked closely together on building a team that complements him. Yeah. So we changed quite a lot of people. And he's in his mid-50s. Mm. And I say that because he's just a great example of how someone could really change. I mean, he had some really crazy blind spots at the beginning and, you know, I was not afraid to tackle those with him. Now we just laugh about them. Mm. He still has those blind spots from a natural perspective. Yeah. He's aware of them.
Yeah.
And he's worked on them and we've worked together on them.
And I'm assuming that sort of cultural maturity probably seeps down into the business as well in terms of people being far more open around their own weaknesses and
for health. You know, and in the beginning of our conversations, one particular area of blind spot, he was like, HR, that's admin, isn't it? And I was like, no, people are the most important thing in the organization. And we had many an amusing conversation. I mean, he's a very, very intellectual person, very smart, completely data driven. If you've ever done that insights profiling, he's probably 100% blue, and I'm probably 100% yellow. And, you know, we're really opposite in styles, but he's opened his mind so much. And that relationship of being the chair, being able to be open, honest, find the right complementary skills.
Yeah, the trust.
The chemistry and the trust is everything in that situation. Yeah.
Oh, really, really great story.
Hope he's not listening then.
Well, you're complimentary there. Yeah. Maybe just to finish up on was around purpose, which I guess I add in sort of values and culture and all that kind of stuff. I mean, again, some examples where you've really had to work hard on that, advice to people who are struggling with what that is.
Yeah, I think purpose feels like it's the new kid on the block in the last 5 years. Before that, we always used to talk about values and we might have had a mission statement. But I think for me, purpose has been the really important instrumental step forward in organisational behaviour and how you communicate it. So I'm a big fan of having purpose. Again, I can think of one or two examples of when I've been in helping a management team and the CEO has gone, oh, it sounds like fluffy stuff. But I've also worked very strongly with those CEOs to help them understand why it matters. So I'm a big advocate of purpose-driven organisations. And I think, you know, if you're hiring people, it should absolutely be part of your interview process that you're able to communicate your purpose very clearly to candidates and that you can almost judge whether a candidate is going to be right for that purpose. Mm. One of the industries actually that I think often gets branded as a controversial industry, but I think it's done really well and it does really well in this is the pharma industry. You know, if you look at the purpose statements of many of the big pharmaceutical companies, they're generally very short and concise. So that's good. You can remember them, but it normally says things like, we're about saving lives. Mm. We're about, you know, making people healthier.
Yeah.
And I think if you want a job in the pharma industry, you're probably going to at some point come in for some flack because of the industry doesn't always have a great reputation. Mm. But you join those organizations because you want to save lives or you want to make people healthier for longer.
Yeah.
You know, they are probably some of the most purpose-driven organizations in the world.
Yeah, and it's really interesting to see your point around forcing yourself to be clear around what your purpose is in senior recruitment.
Yeah.
Can you convey that? Yeah. And then equally, are you getting the response that you genuinely want from that person as a key criteria?
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned about HG's purpose.
Yeah.
You know, we have it on the walls in the office. We made a video with our clients where they were talking about the pensioners that were in their pension funds. And it was our clients talking about teachers and healthcare workers and firefighters. And when we play that video, when we're hiring new people, to help them understand visually what it is we're trying to do. Mm. And nowhere in that conversation are we talking about investing, you know, ARR, return on capital, MOIC. Mm. Those are just not, they're just not purpose-driven statements. They're, of course, important.
Yeah.
But the real thing that we come to work for every day is to make sure that we are growing companies that are sustainable so that we can return the money to look after those people's pensions.
What a great place to finish, Dawn. It's been a real pleasure to have this conversation and thanks very much for your time.
No, well, thank you. I've loved it. Thanks for having me.
Great.
Thank you for listening. We welcome all feedback, questions or topic suggestions for us to cover in future episodes. So please email howtoscale@frogcapital.com. And finally, to make sure you don't miss any future episodes, sign up for the podcast at frogcapital.com/podcast. Prog invests in purpose-driven European software scale-ups, making a positive impact on society. We look for businesses who have reached product market fit and are generating over 3 million euros of annual recurring revenue, what we see as a characteristic of the scale-up phase. It's a stage where businesses are continuing the path of positive growth, purpose-driven route to sustainability and profitability. Our own purpose is to help scale the most exciting purpose-driven software companies in Europe. We do this with both capital and our in-house team of operating partners who work closely with all the companies we invest in to overcome the inevitable challenges scale-ups face.